Thanks so much, Helen. Can I add my welcome to Jono's? I'm one of the pastors here, Andrew. The other pastor is ministering, doing a conference in South Africa at the moment, but he will be back with us in a couple of weeks. That is exactly the kind of reading that you hope you don't get if you're a reader, just lists of names. And it is our conviction at Grace Church that all of the Bible is God's word. And so we try not to pick purple passages. We go, we're last week in Genesis 24, so this week we're in Genesis 25, and we want to let God set the agenda. And in today's passage, it's the last in this series of Abraham, and you know it's the last because he's just died in this passage. And in this passage, we see the distinction between God's chosen people, that's represented by Isaac, the child of promise, and the rest of the world, and they are represented by the other children, the ones either at the beginning of the passage, verses 1 to 4 from Keturah, or the ones at the end of the passage from Hagar in verses 12 to 18. And in the middle is little Isaac on his own. And it is a very clear distinction being made between the line of promise and the rest. So look at verse 5. Abraham gave all he had to Isaac, but to the sons of his concubines, Keturah and Hagar, Abraham gave gifts. And while he was still living, he sent them away from his son Isaac, eastwards to the east country. And we see this deliberate separation, a focus on one line. And so to many people, passages like this one describe precisely what is wrong with Christianity, this us and them. God's favorites and the rest kind of mentality. And the fear is that not simply that this breeds a kind of smug superiority, but that this mentality leads inevitably onto a kind of slippery slope towards oppression. You know the kind of thing, as soon as one group of people think they're better than others, they tend to pull away. They tend to be able to believe the worst about the other group and then potentially to oppress them. And this is the question we are going to think about as we begin. Doesn't an us and them framework lead inevitably to pride and to oppression? And before we get on to how Genesis is going to help us with this whole question, one writer who's been a real help to me on this topic, Tim Keller, he says that when people present this argument to him, his first response when he's faced with this question is to agree. So he says, yes, it's true. Us and them teaching does lead to pride and eventually to oppression very commonly. But then Keller shows that it's harder to avoid than we think it is. The normal solution that is given in our society at the moment to this problem is to try and get all religious people to agree that they've each got a valid but partial perspective on the truth. And you'll have heard the classic illustration of this idea. Is that, you know, the quest for truth is pictured like a mountain and it's got many paths to the top. Each religion is saying their route is the path. Everyone has to take my path. But if only we could look down from the top of the mountain, we would see that all these paths lead eventually to the same destination. They're all equally valid. And there's a very similar illustration you might have heard about blind people describing parts of an elephant. And it's basically teaching the same idea. And it's a very compelling picture the first time that you hear it, until you stop and think about the assumption that is being smuggled into that argument. And the assumption is that the person describing the picture of the mountain or the picture of the elephant is the only person actually who has the whole truth. They are the only person, the elite, the us, who are able to tell all the others, the them, all the ignorant people who are trekking up their different paths, or all the blind people feeling the parts of the elephant, they are the one person who can tell all the ignorant, stupid or blind people what they haven't yet realized. And so actually it is just setting up an alternative us and them, but a very clever one. That's the irony of this sort of teaching, isn't it? The point is that the person who says no one has a superior take on spirituality than anyone else, that itself is a superior take on spiritual reality. How do they know better than anyone else? And when someone says no one should convert anyone else to their view of spiritual reality, in making that statement, that person is trying to convert the listener to their view of religious reality. So this approach, which is very, very common and widespread in our society, it sounds humble the first time you hear it. It sounds reasonable, but it's really not. It's just another us and them imperialism. Only what is worse about this view is that it's subtly trying to pretend that it's not. So I hope we've at least seen, as we approach this topic, that it's more complex than we might at first have thought about. So yes, an us and them framework is dangerous, but it's harder to avoid than we realize. It's instinctive to human beings that we tend to look down on those who don't hold our view, whatever it is. And one of the things I think which highlights this is the way that those who you very often claim to speak for tolerance in our society, they very often end up being some of the most intolerant of those who disagree with them. And maybe you've come up against the sharp end of that, as I know some of us have. So let's get into this passage. And what we're going to see is that Genesis in the Bible gives us a unique and brilliant way through this problem. And it teaches us, this is point one on your sheets or on the screen, that God's people are chosen, but they're chosen for the sake of the rest. And they're chosen only because of God's grace. So that's where we're going. And actually, this is a remarkable teaching. And to the extent that you and I take this on board, this teaching should make Christians into a people who are not just uniquely humble, but it should make us into those who are able to love even those who are hostile to us. So it's a very powerful and life-changing way of seeing the world. So let's get back to the passage. Having seen that there's this distinction in the passage between the line of promise represented by Isaac and everyone else represented by Abraham's other children, even the immediate context of this chapter points to what we've been thinking about in our service so far, which is God's interest in and God's care for all humanity. For example, the fact that the writer does trace the genealogy to other people groups, for example, the Midianites there in verse 2. Actually, there are going to be some key players later in the Bible story as we go forward. For example, Jethro, you might have heard of, Moses' father-in-law, he is a Midianite, and it's his family tree that is being explained here, so that the writer is not just interested in Israel, but in other people groups. And Jethro, as you know, in Exodus 18, he becomes a model believer in the Exodus story, and his advice is received by Moses and instituted in Israel's governance in that chapter. Or another example, in verses 12 to 16, we're introduced to Ishmael's line. And these verses are actually a direct fulfillment of the Lord's promise back in chapter 17 that he will bless Ishmael. And that, I'm quoting verse 20 of that chapter, he will be the father of 12 rulers and I will make him into a great nation. So even the immediate context here in chapter 25 shows that God's love and concern is not just for Isaac and the people of promise, but actually for all people. And actually, as we zoom out in Genesis, we see this point made even more powerfully, because we see that even God's choosing of one group, the few, it's always in the Bible for the sake of the many. And we see that very clearly if you just zoom out and look at the big macro plot line of the book of Genesis. Genesis is obviously a story about Israel's beginnings. How did Israel come to be? Through this guy called Abraham. But crucially, the call of that one man, Abraham, in chapter 12, comes after 11 chapters of showing the backdrop of God's creation of and concern for all people. So the story doesn't start with Abraham. It starts with the Creator God and his concern for the whole world. And then when Abraham is finally called in chapter 12, he's specifically told that the purpose of his call, chapter 12, verse 3, is that all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. Do you see the point? God's purpose from the beginning was always the one for the many. That's the dynamic. And then the climax of the book of Genesis, I guess lots of us will know the story of Joseph. That's how the book ends. His amazing technicolor dream coat. We know that much about him probably. And it's a story, it's an amazing story, and it points us to Christ. And it gives us the pattern that God is going to fulfill later in the person of Jesus, because Joseph is a picture of Christ through one man, in this case Joseph, a man who is hated and persecuted by his brothers. But ultimately, in the story of Joseph, he's someone God will raise up from the pit to rule the world. This, you know, lighting any lights for us about Jesus. But through this one man, the Savior, the whole world will come to him to receive salvation, in that case, from the famine in Joseph's case. So the whole shape of the book of Genesis is heading here. It's all about the one for the many. And the whole thing is actually pointing us forward to the Lord Jesus, the later Joseph who's going to come, the ultimate one for the many. The whole world will be blessed through him and find salvation in him. So I hope we can see, as we look at the whole book of Genesis, it's not parochial. It's not about me, you know, God's little gang and his little club. Yes, he chooses one people, but it's always for the sake of the whole world. And not only that, It's not only that God's people are chosen for the sake of the rest, but it's also, this is the second line there, it's made very clear that God's choosing of his people, Abraham in the beginning, is nothing to do with Abraham's worthiness. It's only because of God's sheer, unqualified, undiluted grace. So I don't know what we think of when we think of Abraham before God called him. Perhaps we have this idea of, you know, this incredible, you know, God-fearing guy, devoutly seeking the Lord, praying desperately that the rest of the world would turn back to God. Actually, the evidence does not point that way at all. Both Ur, where he's from, and then Haran, where Abraham's family also settled for a while, they were centers of pagan worship, actually for a particular god, for the moon god, whose name is Sin. And the clue is in the name. You really shouldn't be worshipping Sin. And Abraham's wife, Sarai, she is named after the moon god's wife. And Abraham's niece, Milcah, she is named after the moon god's daughter. And this pagan background, which is very strongly hinted at in that chapter, is then confirmed later in the Bible when Joshua says to the people, this is later in Joshua 24, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, long ago your ancestors, Terah and his sons, Abraham and Nahor, they lived beyond the Euphrates, and here it is, they served other gods." That is what Abraham was up to before the Lord called him. The fact that there is a people of God at all today, the fact that there is anyone at all who has inherited the faith of Abraham anywhere in the world, it all stems from the sheer, undiluted grace of God. Do you see the point? The Lord did not respond to a humanity who were humbly seeking after him. No, the Lord had to sovereignly intervene in the life of a guy, Abraham, who was running away and serving other gods. And what this means is, if you or I ever think, yeah, I can see why I might be a good, suitable object for God's kindness, if we ever think like that, not only do we not know ourselves very well, I suggest, but we haven't the foggiest idea what God's grace is actually all about. God's grace is never a response to our worthiness. His grace is always an intervention despite what we're like, our unworthiness. And right from the beginning, this is made as clear as day, as plain as it can be, that so that God's people can be sure that, yes, we are chosen. Yes, we are God's precious, dearly loved children, but we are chosen for the sake of others. So we're not to write off others. We're to bless them. And we're chosen not because we're good and we're superior, actually quite the opposite. We're chosen only because of God's sheer grace and kindness to us. And discovering this reality reconfigures our whole identity. And it reconfigures our whole approach to life and to other people. First of all, I guess the first thing is it leads us to worship, doesn't it? What a God we serve. And actually, the more we grasp as we go through our lives and we discover the darkness of our sin, the more we then appreciate the shining radiance of God's mercy and kindness, and the more we will then love and delight in him. That's the first thing. We worship God. And as we grasp this reality, the more we will grow in humility. I know from experience how possible it is to speak to people. You know, perhaps you're speaking about your faith, perhaps you're speaking about something completely else, but the tone that you're speaking in is basically, listen to me, I've got everything sorted out, you don't, and you need to tune in. And we don't say that in so many words. You know, we've learned that's probably a bit proud, and we cover that up, but you can smell it on us, that kind of attitude, the stench of pride and condescension. And you can smell it from 10 paces away. And perhaps you know it is very off-putting as a smell. And yet what a difference it makes when someone starts to internalize what we've been thinking about today. And when we start to approach other people, not as, you know, ignorant, you know, the great unwashed out there, but when we start to approach people as people just like us, people who are lost and in need of a savior, just as we were. Yes, I am chosen by God. Yes, I am dearly loved. But there's no superiority dynamic. All it is one beggar telling another where to find bread. And the more we grasp this dynamic, God's kindness to us, it has an effect on us and it propels us outwards to show kindness to others. We don't just kind of hunker down, pull up the drawbridge. We suddenly go outwards to others. Because, of course, this is part of the reason Jesus called us. God's people are chosen for the sake of the rest. We were never meant as God's people to be buckets of grace. We were always meant to be like the top champagne glass. We were always meant to be, you know, receiving grace so that we can then overflow to others. The Spider-Man comics and films have popularized that phrase, with great power comes great responsibility. And I think for Christians, we don't have to tweak it much, that the Christian truth is this: with great privilege comes great responsibility. So amazingly, there's a problem there in the coloring or the formatting between. Anyway, imagine that says, did it just jump up? That's extraordinary. Okay, thank you. With great privilege comes great responsibility. So that would be a more Christian way of this, having the Spider-Man quote. And amazingly, we, out of all people on earth, we have the most extraordinary privilege. Sometimes when my children were smaller, they used to kind of get wowed by someone who's very rich and famous, and they'd tell me all about, you know, how many X number of billion dollars they earned, and you know, they had their own perfume range or something like that. And I would try and respond with, well, you got to pity those poor billionaires, haven't you? You know, spiritually speaking, we are more like trillionaires. And in the new creation, we really will be trillionaires equivalent. So we really don't need to you know, envy them or be wowed by them. And it's true, we need to grasp this. We have the most incredible privilege. We have the sort of privilege as God's people that, you know, makes you pity the Elon Musks and the Jeff Bezoses of this world. God's people have this incredible future, an incredible wealth ahead of us. And we are chosen for the sake of the rest. The whole purpose of this incredible privilege was not so that we would just hang on to it, but that say that we would be open-handed and bless others with it. And which helps us, hang on. So this, let's kind of recap where we've got. This us and them framework is real, but it's very, very hard to avoid. Even those who claim to be above it actually have their own version of it. But what we're seeing is that the Bible gives us a unique resource for actually being a different kind of people, not an oppressive people, but a humble people who serve others. And I hope we've seen that. And we serve not paternalistically, but humbly. And this passage we're going to see opens for us another dynamic as well, which we also need to understand about being God's chosen people. And this is the second thing we're going to see today, that though God's people may seem weak, we have a glorious future. And one of the great contrasts in this passage between the family of promise and the rest is how weak and pathetic the family of promise is compared to the others. So when Abraham dies, he's 175 years old. There is only one representative, isn't there, of the line of promise, and that is Isaac. And he is mentioned, he gets his middle section, verses 5 to 11, whereas on either side of the Isaac section, there's this long list of the names that Helen had to read. Do you remember verses 1 to 4 and then Keturah's family and 12 to 18, Hagar's family? And we're even told in verse 16, these are the sons of Ishmael, and these are their names by their villages and by their encampments. 12 princes, that little detail there, princes according to their tribes. So Ishmael's family are royal, we're discovering in these verses. And it's underlined that there are 12 of them. That's quite significant in Genesis. Of course, we know that eventually there will be 12 tribes of Israel. So hitting 12 tribes seems to be, in the story of Genesis, a significant marker. It's like when a family hits maturity. It's when the beginnings of nationhood are established. And that is not going to be for another two generations for Isaac's family. It's 10 chapters away in the narrative. Whereas it's striking that Abraham's brother Nahor, he hit the 12 tribe stage right back in chapter 22. And Ishmael, he is hitting the 12 princely tribe stage here in verse 16. And all of this is picking up on a theme which we've already discovered in Genesis back in chapter 4. And that is the theme that very often God plans it that the chosen people look weak, initially at least. And we're going to spend some time actually back in Genesis 4, just seeing how this theme develops in the book of Genesis. The satirist Jonathan Swift, he's the guy who wrote Gulliver's Travels, he famously said, "A lie can travel halfway around the world while the truth is still putting on its shoes." Have you heard that phrase? I think Mark Twain picked up on it in Winston Churchill. And actually, the quote could be adapted to talk about ungodly society more generally, because Genesis 4 is all about how godless society is often very rapid in its development. It can travel halfway around the world, while godly society is still putting on its shoes and taking much longer to get up to speed. And the second half of Genesis 4 is a comparison between two families, yet again. So there's the family of Cain. He's the murderer, you'll remember, who represents the seed of the serpent. That was introduced in chapter 3. And then there's the other family, the family of Seth, the family of promise, who represent the seed of the woman, whose descendant will one day crush the serpent. So these are we're introduced to these two contrasting families. And the key example from the family of Cain is this guy called Lamech. Lamech is a violent man. He's a bigamist. He's got two wives, actually the first bigamist in the Bible. And he's also extremely successful. And he has three sons. And each one of the sons are incredible innovators who irrevocably change the course of human history. And we're introduced in chapter 4, verse 20 to Jabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. So this guy was the first human being to have herds, not just one or two sheep that you might live off, but to keep large numbers of animals and of different kinds, sheep and goats and cattle and donkeys and camels. And this guy has radically changed human life from that moment on. And he's got a younger brother whose name was Jubal, verse 21. He was the father of all those who play lyre and pipe. So this guy is the first musician. This is the person who brought musicianship into this world. So imagine what a difference he has made to all of our lives. And you can see this is a very high-flying family. Imagine the pressure, you know, if those are your two older brothers. But then we're introduced to the third brother, and he's called Tubal-Cain. And he was the forger of all instruments of bronze and iron. Wow. This guy invented metalwork, something which I think we agree has impacted every culture since. So every one of these sons, Nobel Prize winners of their day. No question. They are amazing overachievers. There's your metalwork. And then we're introduced to the other family, the also-rans, the line of Seth. And verse 26 says, to Seth also was born a son, and he was called Enosh. And that very name, Enosh, means weakness, in case we missed the point. And then it says, at that time, people began to call upon the name of the Lord. So this is all this family have got. They've got nothing impressive, no Nobel Prize winners. But the one thing they have is this humble dependence on God. They call upon the name of the Lord. That's all they have. And in chapter 4, we're really being invited to ask the question, which family would we rather be in? Which would you rather be in, the Cainsons or the Sethsons? Which is the better family? And of course, the answer to that question is, well, it depends. Depends on whether you take the long view. And if we zoom out in Genesis, it's a no-brainer which family you want to be part of, because we know that by the time you get to chapter 6, the line of Cain is no more. It is a dead-end family, and they all get washed away in Noah's flood. Whereas the line of Seth, weak as it seems, this is the line that's going to be the line of Noah, and then the line of Abraham, and then Judah, and then finally Jesus Christ. This is going to be the family from whom the serpent crusher will come and through whom the world will be saved. And in a sense, Genesis 25 is picking up on this same question that was raised in chapter 4. Which family in chapter 25 do we want to be part of? There's the large clan of Ishmael, 12 princely tribes, we told in verse 16, or the also-rans, the lonely, unimpressive line of, well, it didn't take long for Helen to read it, just Isaac. So weak, so unimpressive. Actually, interestingly, there is a place in the Bible which specifically references Genesis 25 later in the Bible and which helps us answer this precise question. And later in the Bible, the prophet Isaiah, he's addressing the nation of Israel hundreds of years later, and it's when they're contemplating a particularly low point in Israel's history. They're conquered by Babylon, they're exiled far away from home, everything's gone wrong. And Isaiah, in chapter 60, he tells the people, don't worry, consider what is ahead for you. And the verse says this, hopefully you can read it. Isaiah chapter 60, arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord has risen upon you. So Isaiah is saying that one day God's glory will shine on Israel like a spotlight, picking them out for everyone else to see. Verse 3, and nations shall come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your rising. Then verse 5, then you shall see and be radiant. Your heart shall thrill and exult, because the wealth of the nations shall come to you. And he's encouraging the people, there is a day coming when you will no longer be a landless joke of a nation anymore. That everything will be reversed and the nations will stream to you. And what's more, they will be coming and bringing tribute, offering you their wealth. And then Isaiah lists which nations this is going to include. Verse 6. A multitude of camels shall cover you, the young camels of Midian and Ephah, all those from Sheba shall come. And Sheba are the people from what is now called Yemen. And crucially, all these three people groups are from, you guessed it, Genesis 25, the first few verses, Keturah's family. And they're being quoted here in Isaiah 60. And then it goes on, they shall bring gold and frankincense and shall bring good news, the praises of the Lord. They'll all be worshipping the one true God. Verse 7, all the flocks of Kedar shall be gathered to you. The rams of Nebaioth shall minister to you. And once again, Kedar and Nebaioth, these are people groups from what would now be Saudi Arabia and Jordan. And crucially, they are lifted here straight from Genesis 25. They're those from Ishmael's family. So these verses here in Isaiah, they describe a day, an amazing day, when the Lord's beauty is going to shine on his people. And the nations of Genesis 25, the princely 12, etc., they are finally going to be attracted to God's people. And not only are they going to bring their tributes, they will one day be united in one humanity, verse 6, together worshipping the one true God. It's actually another reminder, isn't it, of this one for the many dynamic that we saw earlier. Ultimately, through this one people, all the nations are going to be finally blessed. And on that day, it's going to be very clear that however weak, however pathetic the people of God seem, and they seem pretty weak, don't they, in Genesis 25, one day they are going to be the ultimate in crowd. One day, everyone is going to be muscling in, you know, elbowing in, trying to get into this family and worship their God. And they're going to come bringing their treasures with them. And we're thinking, when did this all happen? Well, it clearly began to be fulfilled, you know, when Jesus was born, didn't it? And that's the point Matthew makes in his gospel when he reports how the wise men brought their treasures from the ends of the earth to worship the newborn king. You probably know that story from Christmas time. And what was in their treasures? Well, it included gold and frankincense. And you can see them carrying it up there. You know, this is exactly what was prophesied in Isaiah 60. And it's being fulfilled in Jesus. And although this started to be fulfilled at Jesus' arrival, it is continuing every day. The nations today are streaming in to worship Israel's Messiah. And if you want proof of that, look around you. Here, thousands of miles away, hundreds of years later, we from all different places have gathered to worship the Messiah of Israel. And this prophecy will ultimately be fully fulfilled at the end of the gospel age. And we read about that in the last two chapters of the Bible. There will finally be a holy city coming down out of heaven from God. And the city, we're told, has no need of sun or moon to shine on it. For the glory of God gives it light, and its lamp is the Lamb. You can hear the echoes there of Isaiah 60. By its light will the nations walk, and the kings of the earth will bring their glory into it. They will bring into it the glory and honor of the nations. This is where history is finally heading in the new creation. On that day, it is going to be a total no-brainer which team, which family, which line you want to be part of. On that day, when the treasures of the nations, including from Midian and Ephah and Sheba, from Keturah's line, including from Kedar and Nebaioth from Ishmael's line, including from London and Lagos and Las Vegas and all around the world, all these treasures are going to be brought into the heavenly city to honor the Messiah from Isaac's line, little Isaac. And on that day, can I say, it will be brilliant to be in this family. So it might feel pretty weak and pathetic in the meantime. In fact, it will. But it's definitely the family you want to be part of. When I was a teenager, there was a Christian pop group that we were into called Delirious, and we'd go around the country trying to, you know, listen to their gigs. And they got to number 20 in the charts. This is a big moment. And I remember thinking, oh, 20, you know, if only we can get them, you know, buy a few extra records, etc. If only we can get them to number one, then surely revival will take place. All my friends will want to become Christians. I mean, how could they not if they're at number one, obviously? And I still today get a little bit overexcited about Christians in the public eye. You know, like recently Kate Forbes was nearly elected First Minister of Scotland 2 weeks ago. And I was thinking, you know, surely people will start taking Christians seriously when, you know, we've got people like Kate Forbes on the top. You know, we'll be more influential, we'll be more intellectually credible, we'll be cool, we'll be powerful. Surely it's like the Delirious dream all over again. And sometimes, and you may have been in this kind of church, there are churches that try hard to project a kind of success mentality, and the pastors have, you know, teeth and all that stuff, and I do my best. Anyway, the point is that is not God's normal means of reaching his world today. Deliberately, Genesis 25 reminds us that God has deliberately organized the world so that his chosen people will always seem weak. And the fact is, if you look around, the church is not, I don't want to be insulting, but it doesn't tend to be full of Nobel Prize winners. Although, thankfully, there are some. I think Andrew met Christian Nobel Prize winner a few months ago. But the normal thing, and this is what Paul said to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 1, he says, not many of you were powerful. Not many of you were of noble birth. I mean, that is what we see as we look around the world. Not many, as you look around Christians in the nations of the world, we are mostly hobbits and dwarfs, you know, in terms of social status. Not many of us are elves and wizards. I think that's just a fact. And that's part of the reason why being a Christian is tough, isn't it? It's very unlikely to boost your street cred. It's not going to get you promoted at work. It's not going to get you into the corridors of power or the in crowd at school. And therefore, you know, it is easy for us to feel discouraged. And maybe we feel that on a daily basis. Perhaps we do wish we were in with the cool kids, culturally speaking. And yet the Bible keeps reminding us that though God's chosen people seem weak, this is the second point here, we do have this glorious future ahead of us. And we should therefore be very glad to be in Team Jesus. This really is the best family to be in, whatever the cost right now. It's definitely the team you want to sign up for. And on that final day, everyone will know it. So please don't be discouraged. What a God. He's given us this hope. So I'm going to leave a bit of time for quiet. And there's some questions on the bottom of your sheets, coffee questions, which might be of interest. But why not use the time now just to remember what it is to be one of God's chosen people and the great privilege, the calling we have, and the great future that awaits us. And in a moment, we will start thinking about the Lord's Supper and the great privilege we have there.